Hey, this is Mary. Welcome to Voices of Vets, a podcast where we meet real veterans and hear their stories. All right. So, Drew, thank you so much for joining us on Voices of Vets. And I'm going to start off with, did you serve?
Yeah, thank you. I have served. I'm still serving. I'm in the Texas Army National Guard. I've been in the National Guard for 21 years. I joined the New Mexico Army National Guard in 2003.
Okay. And then when did you go from New Mexico to Texas?
Well, actually, I transferred to Arizona first. I did a tour in Iraq with New Mexico in 07, 08. So I did my first 6 years with the New Mexico Guard. I was briefly transferred to the Arizona Guard while I went to Motorcycle Mechanics Institute in Phoenix. And then from there, I transferred to my home state of Texas.
All right.
And I've been with Texas since 2010.
Why did you choose the reserves?
That is a good question because I wanted to serve full time. Like I wanted to be active duty, but it was mainly relationships that kept me in the reserves. So I married my high school sweetheart from New Mexico, and that marriage didn't work out. And when I was done with my second deployment with Texas, I met my wife now, Jennifer, and so stayed in Dallas to be near her.
Awesome. Well, and thank you for your service. Do you come from a military family?
Yes. My grandparents served. My dad's father served in the Korean War. He retired a lieutenant colonel from the Air Force. And my mother's father was in the Navy. He, I believe he was an engineer on Higgins landing craft.
Okay.
Is what they're called. But he wasn't career, so he did. He did his service with the Navy during World War II, and then when his time was up, he became an accountant for Exxon. So,
wow. Okay.
Skipped a generation, and then it was my turn.
Nice. So, what made you want to join the military other than having family?
9/11. I was in math class in 10th grade during the attack, and we got pulled out of math, or got pulled out of class. We all got gathered up. I was in a boarding school in Georgia, and we just watched the news for the rest of the day. The counselors figured out what to do with us, and I was a sophomore, so I was too young to join then, but I got my parents' permission to join when I was 17. So as soon as I finished high school, I was enlisted. I was actually enlisted before finishing high school, but then report to MEPS right after high school.
So you said you had gone to Iraq. Your intention was to go serve in that, over there in all of that conflict?
Especially in Afghanistan, although I never did actually get to serve in Afghanistan. My first tour with underneath President Bush was to Iraq in 07, came back in 08. My second tour was with under President Obama, and then I went to the Horn of Africa in a small country called Djibouti, just north of Somalia, at the mouth of the Red Sea. And I didn't deploy overseas under President Trump. And then deployed back to Iraq with President Biden. So my intent was to fight the Taliban, but never actually went to Afghanistan.
Okay. All right. So tell me a little bit about boot camp.
I enlisted as a 13 Bravo, which is Army code for cannon crewman, for military occupational specialty. There's trained to fire 155 millimeter self-propelled howitzers, so like a tank with a bigger turret and a longer tube to fire artillery. I was at Fort Sill in Lawton, Oklahoma. I enjoyed and excelled at the basic training experience because I actually wanted to be an infantryman, but I enlisted in New Mexico. And at the time, New Mexico did not have any infantry units. So I took the most combat arms skill set that they had, and that was field artillery. And wasn't enthusiastic about being in field artillery until the culminating exercise, what they call the Red Leg Challenge. And that was a big field training exercise where we actually got to fire all the guns as a battery, so six guns firing on a line, and six great big 155 millimeter artillery pieces going off
Man.
together. A really incredible experience, but it was the last time I actually got to fire them because then I reported to my unit, and it had just been decided that my unit would transition to light infantry, so the state sold our artillery pieces to Utah, and we became light infantry. So then I got to do an MOS transition to 11 Bravo infantry.
Okay, great. Other than Iraq and Djibouti, did you get to visit any other countries while you during service?
I'm trying to think. Don't no. I transitioned through a couple countries. Had a layover in Germany where the plane broke, and I got to explore Frankfurt, Germany for for a night, for an evening. So that was really nice. I was actually coming home from my most recent deployment, which was ended last summer. We were flying home, and those planes were chartered. We do a lot of the charter flights. Atlas Air is a big contractor, and flying on a 747 from Kuwait to Fort Hood and or Fort Cavazos now. The plane broke. It was leaking fuel when they refueled in Germany, so they tried to fix it, but they couldn't fix it before the air crew's duty day timed out. So then they had to go into a mandatory rest period, so we all got to take buses to Frankfurt and have dinner, have a beer that we had, have for our first beer in a year.
Wow.
Really enjoy seeing something green for a change. So the weather happened to be beautiful, beautiful day in early May last year, and very green and good food and
Nice.
nice break.
So what was your favorite place that you lived abroad?
Well, I really, I don't know. I don't know that I have a favorite place. The amenities in Kuwait were pretty nice, but the area in Kuwait is desolate, desert. It's like what you think of when you see, a movie that's based in Saudi Arabia. I mean, Kuwait borders Saudi. So it's just desolate Arabian Peninsula and sand. If you like the desert, and I do enjoy the desert, there's a unique beauty to that kind of desolation. The Al Asad Air Base is in southern, maybe I don't know if you call it southwestern Iraq, and that was pretty unique. That like the sand out there is like talcum powder. It's not granular. It's just, I'm not a geologist, so I assume, that it's the age of the dirt, the sand out there, that it's so eroded and worn down that it's such a fine powder. And then flying from Al Asad into the Baghdad, you fly over the cradle of civilization, and fly over the rivers, and flying west into Jordan, seeing the River Jordan. And that was something that would look like a scene from Dante's Inferno when I was coming back out of Jordan into Iraq. There was something like 15 to 20 dust devils blowing around an empty wasteland,
Oh my.
It just looked like some sort of, hellscape. Up north in northern Iraq was Erbil, the capital of Kurdistan, and it was a, Christian province, so you had Christian monasteries on the side of a cliff. And
Beautiful.
if you went east towards Iran, you went up into the mountains in an area called Suleimania, and it looked like Vail, really. And so it was just this, very bizarre place to be, associated with Iraq. And didn't, there's really nothing to enjoy about Djibouti. It's all red lava rock, and it's, I don't know if it's hotter than Kuwait, but it's definitely, Kuwait and Djibouti are both the hottest places to be that I've ever been on Earth. So
Wow.
temperatures would get up, routinely for like months above 125. So it'd cool off into the low 100s or high 90s at night.
That is incredibly hot.
Yeah.
So you don't have air conditioning or anything like that in your quarters when you're stationed out there, or do you?
No, that's not true. And especially now, it's gotten so much better. When I went, 15, what's 2007? 24 minus 7, 17 years ago? Gosh. That was, we had a lot more rolling brownouts and stuff like that. And, when you're trying to sleep in one of those tents and the power goes out in the middle of the day, that was a unique experience. But this time around, much later, we were stationed in rooms and buildings. They're kind of like a double wide or a triple wide, right? Like, so it had rooms, and each room had what you call a mini split, like the Mitsubishi air conditioners, that ductless air conditioners. And those things, those suckers ran around the clock, and they never quit. So that was actually something I was really surprised with, their performance this go around.
How many
Are you?
people are you sharing a living space with?
It depends on your rank. So if I had been one rank higher, I'm a chief warrant officer too. So if I had been a three or higher, then I would have had a room to myself.
Oh.
But I didn't have it too bad. I had one anywhere from one to two roommates. But I had to walk to the bathroom, the field grade officers had their own bathrooms, so that would have been nice. But no, it was it's not like watching MASH, or even in like the early days when I went and I was living in a like an air mobile tent, which is kind of like what the swamp was in MASH. It was a GP medium tent or something like that. And I lived in those my first go around, or at least for part of my first tour. Lived most of it in Saddam's horse stables,
Oh, wow.
but or former horse stable, just concrete stalls. It's not like I don't know. I guess I just kind of expected it to be like MASH. I don't know why.
So you mentioned your rank, Chief Warrant Officer 2. What rank are you most proud to have earned? And tell me why.
This is it. I one of the reasons I and maybe the primary reason I w enlisted into the National Guard in the first place, my intent was to, go to college. I graduated high school from the New Mexico Military Institute. It has a junior college and an early commission program, one of five in the country, where you get your commission as a second lieutenant after 2 years with your associate's degree. And I was already enlisted. I enlisted, took a year off, enlisted, and served in my unit. And I came back to NIMI and thought I knew what the Army was all about as a, private first class or specialist. And didn't have the patience to deal with ROTC kids. And I couldn't see that I was being so short-sighted that I just needed to get past dealing with them and get my degree and get my commission, that I washed out, dropped out of ROTC, and eventually dropped out of college altogether, and never got my commission. And fast forward to 2018, so 14 years after failing that, I was selected for Warrant Officer Candidate School after I had applied for and was selected for flight training to become a helicopter pilot. So I fly Chinook helicopters now as a warrant officer.
Nice. Awesome.
So yeah, becoming a warrant officer is the pinnacle of my education and my career.
That's amazing. That's wonderful. Do you have any medals or citations, that you've received?
A lot of people joke these days, especially, with my generation kind of being known for participation awards and stuff like that. So a lot of them are campaign medals, right? And you could look at it cynically and say that it's a participation award. But showing up, being where you're supposed to be, doing what you're supposed to do is the job. And that yeah, so there's that. I would say out of all of them, my highest award is air medal with a combat device. So that's what I earned, the highest medal I earned, and I earned that on this last deployment, because I deployed as a Chinook pilot. But probably the one I am still most proud of is my Humanitarian Service Medal. And that was earned in 2005 when I went to Louisiana for Hurricane Katrina.
Okay. All right. So the Texas Army Reserve, you're not just looking to serve abroad. You serve here too in the United States as well.
Yeah, the National Guard is a dual role. So we answer to the governor of, whichever state you're serving. In 2005, I was in the New Mexico Guard still. You're also, sworn to obey the orders of the president. So you're a dual role. You can be activated by Congress, or you can be activated by your governor. So,
Okay.
at 2005 for Hurricane Katrina, because of the nature of National Guard, we don't have to wait for like a special congressional session to declare an emergency. All it took was a phone call from the Louisiana governor's office to the New Mexico governor's office in requesting assistance. It was tough. We worked for 3 days straight with no sleep, just to get ready to go and take everything we need. And then we got on board a KC-135, which was an air tanker. But it's a big jet, and we boarded that and flew into a naval air station just outside of New Orleans, and then we ended up working in Plaquemines Parish, which was I hadn't seen the movie, but my stepmom told me it was the setting for Steel Magnolias.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, it just took us 3 days just to get ready. We were there for several weeks.
Okay.
We were doing search and recovery, as I think it was probably 5 days after the storm before we got there. We were doing search and recovery, checking homes for, bodies. And we had cordoned off, essentially had, martial law declared, because of the way things had deteriorated in New Orleans in the Superdome, and looting and everything in New Orleans. There was martial law declared, so no citizens were allowed into Plaquemines Parish. There were no citizens in Plaquemines when we showed up, because if you stayed, you would have died. It was total annihilation down there.
Oh my gosh.
So there weren't many people who chose to stay, but no one lived that did. And it was mainly just gone. It was 90 miles of new coastline and steps, concrete steps that went up to nothing. The homes were completely gone off their foundations. So we were living in the high school gymnasium,
Okay.
sleeping on cots. And before, eventually, when citizens were allowed to come back and search their homes or search for their homes, depending on what the case was, and then they started cooking for us, and that was a welcome change, because then they cooked great food for us instead of eating MREs the whole time. So that was good.
Speaking of food, what was the best and worst military food you were served?
Okay. So in Iraq this time, the menial chores and like contracting, like the low-level contracting jobs, were predominantly employed by Indians and Sri Lankans. And especially at the Al-Asad Air Base in Iraq. They had very good Indian food. Because those dudes were cooking for themselves, and
Right.
so that food was very delicious. I didn't even know I liked chickpea curry until I tried theirs.
It's
And
good.
it was excellent. And then the worst was my first tour in Iraq. I worked in a location that was off of the main base, and so we didn't have our own chow hall. So then chow had to be trucked over to us, and it was always like the leftovers from the main chow hall, and it was always like over, it just sat and steamed the whole time till it got to us. So it was a bunch of soggy chicken tenders and a
Not
bunch of
great.
terrible food, and I mostly just ate blueberry Pop-Tarts because that was the only flavor we had. So then, if it was real bad, then I'd just have a Pop-Tart. And our only flavor was blueberry Pop-Tart.
Blueberry Pop-Tarts.
And I haven't had one since. So,
That's what I was wondering. You can't look at another blueberry Pop-Tart, right?
no.
Oh. Tell me about some of the special people you met. Is there anyone who stands out?
I mean, it's hard for me to narrow down. Like my buddies and I, especially after becoming an aviator, my best friends were also former infantrymen. I guess we just have some sort of, gravitational personality that goes on. But I've made great friends and met incredible men that have served in much more challenging environments than I have, like Army Rangers and Special Forces guys that I've gotten to work with that really incredible people with an unmatched personal drive and selflessness, that is uncharacteristic, especially in the civilian population these days.
Is there any one or two memorable experiences or stories from your time serving so far that stand out that you can tell us about?
Probably not that I can talk about now.
Okay. Well, what about a funny story? Tell me a funny story that you experienced that could only happen in the military.
But funny is a different perspective, especially from service members and especially from
Well, funny to
infantry.
you.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, I guess there was one time that we had we were allowed to drink in the Horn of Africa. Even though it was like you're not allowed to drink in Iraq or Afghanistan, but we
Because of
were.
the culture.
Yeah, and we were allowed to drink in the Horn of Africa, even though it's also a Muslim country. But whatever, we weren't going to complain. And so we were leaving the bar, and we, the army unit, and it's a unique base where it's pretty evenly divided, one quarter each, Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marines. Roll around that base, and we were the only ones who didn't have gaiters, John Deere, side by side, and so we had to walk everywhere. And then the Navy guys, I guess, were trusting enough, they didn't lock up their stuff. So if we came out of the bar and there was an unlocked gaiter, well, then we would take that. And one time we got back to our barracks across the base, and my sergeant pointed out that that gator that we borrowed belonged to NCIS, the criminal investigation services. So we probably needed to get that back.
Oh my gosh. That's
So.
good. tell me, how does your military experience affect your life today?
Well, I mean, it directly affects it because I continue to serve as a citizen soldier, right? So, training for us as helicopter pilots, we have the same flight minimums as active duty. So that means that we get additional funding for our training, and we train usually once a week or every other week instead of just 1 week in a month. I get to serve my community directly during natural disasters. I've done firefighting with the Chinook helicopter. That was an immensely rewarding work that I did just recently up in Amarillo for the 1.2 million acre wildfire that is now the largest in our country's history. I mean, it's a personal satisfaction of serving your fellow man, and being a line of defense between flames and someone's home.
Exactly. And Drew, can you tell me how does your military service shape who you are? How does it affect who you are today?
I'd like to say I'm more disciplined. Whether or not that's true, maybe not always, but hopefully usually. discipline, being able, it's especially in aviation, when learning to do things by checklist meant that if you take a checklist type of approach to tasks in your personal life, it helps. I mean, it's been noted for a long time that if you want to set long-term goals, you set short-term goals and make them achievable, and that sort of deal. So that kind of checklist mentality, but even just daily stuff of things that I need to do today, and just checking off a list. It's just like starting an aircraft. You just go down the list and do things that you need to do.
Awesome. And Drew, what advice would you give to someone who's considering joining the military?
Do get it in writing what you want to do. I tell like any young man that wants to join, that wants to be something spectacular, like a Ranger or a Green Beret or something like that. Get it in writing. If the Army doesn't want to do it right now, then wait, or talk to another recruiter who will get you that contract. Because their job is to get people into the military and to fill the needs of the military. Maybe the Army needs more military police right now, or maybe they need more wheeled mechanics. And it's like, they might tell them something slick like, "Oh yeah, well you can be a wheeled mechanic for the 75th Ranger Regiment." Well, maybe you can, but if you want to be the guy who's, jumping out of an aircraft and kicking in doors, you just get that in writing. If you don't want to do that, get some other job in writing onto your contract, because that's what you're going to do. No matter what they tell you, you might do later.
Well, I really thank you for sharing, for your transparency, for all the insight, and for your time, Drew. And I just And I just thank you for your service again.
Thanks for asking. This has been nice talking to you.
Thanks, Drew. Thanks again for tuning into the Voices of Vets podcast today. If you haven't done so already, make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any of our episodes of Real Vets and Their Stories. And don't forget to visit our website, voicesofvets.us, where you can check out the photo gallery and more.